Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, an Alaska Native corporation promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state, and the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512.
Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The National Transportation Safety Board released alcohol test results today for the captain and other figures in the Exxon Valdez disaster. The captain has been fired. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, Governor Cooper says he won't close Port Valdez, for the time being at least, and the oil continues to spread to beaches in Prince William Sound. Governor Cooper says he won't use his emergency powers to close the Port of Valdez, even though the oil industry may not be in compliance with pollution control laws. Peter Kenyon reports.
The Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund had called on Cooper to shut down the limited tanker traffic that resumed in Valdez on Tuesday. The group argued that oil spill control equipment being used to fight Friday's oil slick could not be considered also ready to respond to another spill, as required by Alyeska's oil spill contingency plan. The governor shared those concerns as the tanker traffic resumed, but Thursday afternoon he said he's unlikely to use an emergency closure immediately of the port because that would be too extreme right now.
My initial inclinations were to take a look at the possibility of closing the port until they had put together a plan that would clearly work and that was satisfactory to us. At the moment, since it's so clear that there is a capability to respond to another spill, should one occur in the next few days at least, that there's no reason to stop it right now.
The governor says the issue is still under review, and the state has no intention of allowing any illegal operation of the port. But he says as a practical matter, the state wouldn't have to rely on just the resources of Alyeska if another spill occurred now.
I don't know whether Alyeska is capable of dealing with anything, but certainly the response team that is now in place is in a much better position to respond to a major oil spill than any other time that can be imagined.
The decision takes pressure off the relatively small storage capacity at Valdez and avoids a whole series of potential problems for the oil industry and the state. If the port remained closed for several days, the pipeline would have to be shut down, and state officials aren't really sure what that would entail, aside from the obvious loss of revenue and crude oil supply. One potential problem that has been mentioned is that an idle pipeline could be difficult to start back up again if the oil cooled and thickened in the line. Right now, the Coast Guard is allowing tankers into Valdez Arm only under escort from two tugboats and only during daylight hours. Coast Guard spokesperson Lieutenant Ed Villashevitz says no tankers are allowed into the harbor with oil on their hulls. Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund attorney Stuart Elgee says the fund is considering taking legal action itself to close the port, but it will wait until Cooper meets with Alyeska officials Friday before making that decision. In other developments, the White House postponed a Saturday meeting between President Bush and the governor, and no new date has been set for that meeting. Cooper also submitted a bill calling for a $20 million emergency appropriation to deal with the cleanup. Senate President Tim Kelly says he expects the Senate to pass the bill Friday, and it should clear the House soon after that. Kelly says the legislature fully intends to recover any state money spent on the cleanup from Exxon. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The National Transportation Safety Board today confirmed the presence of alcohol in the blood of the captain of the Exxon Valdez and said the amount was above the acceptable limit. Bob King reports from Valdez.
Reports of Captain Joseph Hazelwood's drinking problems surfaced not long after the grounding of the 1,000-foot supertanker. Now the National Transportation Safety Board says tests conducted after the accident found a blood alcohol level that was in excess of acceptable limits. The NTSB's chief investigator, William Woody, said there were two separate tests conducted.
Based on urine sample, 0.09. The blood, 0.061% alcohol.
Those tests were taken about 10 and a half hours following the accident. Woody could not say whether Hazelwood had any drinks following the grounding, since Hazelwood has not spoken with investigators on the advice of his attorneys, and Hazelwood's cabin has not been searched for any such evidence. Drinking aboard a supertanker like the Exxon Valdez is strictly against company policy, and Woody says the level of alcohol in Hazelwood's system was well above Coast Guard limits.
A limit of 0.04% or above is considered too high a level of alcohol for a person to be in charge of a vessel like the Valdez.
Release of the blood alcohol test results ended a week of speculation about the captain's reported drinking. The pilot, which led the vessel out of the Valdez terminal, said he smelled alcohol on Hazelwood's breath, as did the Coast Guard officer who first responded to the grounded tanker. Hazelwood's driver's licenses had been suspended in two states for DWI convictions. Alcohol tests conducted on other crew members, including the vessel's third mate, proved negative. It was the third mate, not the captain, who was on the bridge at the time of the grounding. Still, Woody says it's the captain who's in charge of the ship.
Oh, he wasn't actually, he was actually in charge of the vessel. The master is always has responsibility for his vessel. Yes.
In Valdez, I'm Bob King.
Crude oil from the Exxon Valdez is sloshing over miles of beaches in Prince William Sound today. The cleanup effort is still largely concentrated on trying to keep the oil out of critical habitat areas, but experts say it'll end up taking an appalling toll on wildlife. They'll be talking about the spill impacts at a news briefing tonight. Steve Heimel has a preview.
The latest observation flights are reporting a very different-looking oil spill today. The crude oil is beginning to congeal, to gel up into tarry ribbons sweeping through the sea. Jim Hayden is the state's spill cleanup coordinator. He says oil has been leaking from the tanker continuously, and as it ages, it changes.
If it's further in towards the vessel, it's still fairly black and it flows fairly well. As you move away on towards the outer edges of the plume, it's becoming more viscous. It's becoming more like a tarry substance. It is sticking to the beaches. It is sticking to the beaches.
One observer told me it had changed so much he didn't even recognize it for miles. As fishermen had feared, the oil was not staying in a concentrated mass, but is getting caught up in complicated currents around the islands, repeatedly exposing them.
It's flowing back and forth in the coves and in the channels between the islands, and of course, depending on the tides, whether they're ebbing or flowing, that would govern the direction. But it seems to be working its way slowly down between Knight Island and Montague Island and Knight Island and the mainland.
Accounts of effects on wildlife vary a lot right now, and this is understandable when you see how remote and vast this country is. From an airplane, there's a lot you're not going to see, and that's how most observations are being made. Animal rescue missions are going out on boats. Much of the mortality won't be known for years, in fact, and it will probably be scientifically disputed because the evidence will be indirect from wildlife counts. Oiled sea otters simply sink, for instance, and for the most part won't ever be seen again. Tony DeGange of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the effect on sea birds can take some time to show up.
And with sea otters, we expect to see a fairly rapid result because sea otters are really dependent on that fur for insulation, and we suspect they get hypothermic really fast. Birds, on the other hand, depending on the degree of oiling, may take a little bit longer to die. They have a little more water repellency on their feathers and the like. So I suspect it's going to be a longer process than everyone's expecting to see some immediate large-scale die-offs of birds, and it just may take a little longer before it starts showing up. We do know there's large numbers of birds out there that are diving birds that are susceptible to oil. So, and we know the oil is moving into places where those birds are. So I expect to see some effects.
But it is known that the oil is reaching into important seabird habitat areas on the north end of Montague Island and Green Island, though some reports suggest parts of those islands remain unexposed. The blobbed-up oil is exposing about 600 square miles of plankton, too, and the effects of that on all the creatures that feed on the plankton and all the creatures that feed on them will also have to be assessed indirectly. Not all the news has been dismally bad. Some places they thought would be oiled won't be, and some creatures do seem to be surviving it.
For the last few days, we've seen lots of sea lions in the oil, even in some of the thick stuff, and they don't seem to be covered with oil. Somehow they seem to be able to manage to keep it off themselves.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network in Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
The executive director of the Alaska Center for the Environment, Sue Liebenson, is angry and frustrated. She has all kinds of equipment and volunteers ready to help the cleanup effort in Prince William Sound. She's told both Exxon and the state what's available, but so far nobody's taken her up on the offers.
I spent most of yesterday trying to see if Exxon or the state, and it sounds like Exxon is making the calls here, would be interested in a donated skimmer.
A company in California says they have a Harbor Sea-Vac skimmer ready to help with the cleanup. It could handle about 10,000 gallons of oil at a time. Liebenson says its use would be donated. All the company would need is an assurance of reimbursement for any damages to the equipment.
It was kind of interesting. They said they've gotten lots of calls, but no firm purchase orders. It kind of sounds like Exxon's spending time shopping around, and they made the point that if Exxon's going to need large quantities of boom, which they will, they should be ordering it now so that it's available instead of waiting. They said they got the first calls on Saturday, but they still have yet to get any firm purchase orders.
Liebenson says the fishermen in Cordova have spent several hundred thousand dollars of their own money to secure equipment, and there seems to be plenty out there, but it's just not moving.
Exxon just announced that they have 42,000 feet of protective boom ready to go. Well, that's about 8 miles of boom. We've got several thousand miles of coast in the Sound to be concerned with. I mean, they are just totally below the mark in the amount of boom that we're going to need up here if we're serious about protecting coastlines.
The Exxon Command Center in Valdez says it's been inundated with calls. Anyone who has equipment that they think might be useful should send a fax to Exxon. The fax number is area code 907-835-5560. Exxon requests a cover letter with the specifications of the equipment, where it's located, and whether it's a donation, lease, or for sale. The Exxon Command Center telephone number is 835-5562. The whaling people of Alaska's Arctic coast have their own special reasons for being concerned about the Valdez oil spill. Earl Finkler reports on the reactions of one barrel whaling captain.
I'm really mad, and I hope I share the governor's point of view. And I think they did a number on us. I think both the president and the governor should do get on their case. They have to pay for it.
That's whaling captain Arnold Brower Jr. of Barrel. He and his neighbors have tried to work cooperatively with the oil industry for almost two decades. But even before the Valdez spill, there were many concerns raised at meeting after meeting about the impact of offshore oil drilling on subsistence resources and the environment. Now, after a week of reports from Valdez, Brower is looking for more than just promises and vague plans.
It makes me really furious. It's so bad that all along we had these public hearings that they have oil spill contingency plans if they tankered them from Canada to the South United States through our waters, and they can't even do a decent response in the Valdez area on account of that one small piece of ice trying to go around it or something. But it just really ticked me off. And after they have made us make some commitments and telling us that they can clean it up, so we put a lot of trust in those things. Now I think from now on they have to show us that they can do it. I think that from now on that they have to have a plan in place that we have seen that works.
With some of the oil industry's credibility on the rocks, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has emerged as the main source of information about cleanup capabilities in the Arctic. While there are no large tankers to keep track of, there are numerous storage facilities and offshore drill sites to worry about. DEC Field Officer Thor Cutler recently visited Chevron's Karluk well, 7 miles out in the Beaufort Sea. He described the visit to David Harding of KBRW News.
I walked into their pad and I said that there's a, rumor has it there's a spill. And that was about 8:20 in the morning on the 15th.
How'd they do?
They performed adequately. We marked out an area, and they deployed equipment, they called in personnel, and they responded within 5 hours that they found the spill. They responded with the equipment and the people, and they adequately cleaned up the spills. Now, there was no, this was not a spill. This was a spill drill. So the simulation did not include spilling oil, but marking an area and developing a scenario for them to follow, a what-if situation, because we will not dump a contaminant into the ocean to test their capability.
There have been complaints from the North Slope Borough that DEC's oil spill drills do not give an accurate picture of readiness, because DEC alerts the companies ahead of time that a test may occur. Rich Cormack of DEC.
I guess you could say that it hasn't been a total surprise. You know, they've been getting a little bit of lead time. We haven't walked up there and said, this is it, no. I mean, it's something that we do have the option to do, but we haven't done that yet in our region.
Do you think it should be done?
Well, I don't know. You know what I think? I think people are going to be a little more conservative about stuff after this Valdez incident.
In Barrow, I'm Earl Finkler.
Probably the most infamous piece of real estate in Alaska right now is Bly Reef. The well-known hazard to navigation was named by Captain George Vancouver in the summer of 1794 when he explored Prince William Sound. The name is taken from Vancouver's shipmate at the time, William Bly, whose cruelty toward his crew was immortalized in the story Mutiny on the Bounty. Until the Exxon Valdez struck Bly Reef last week, only one other ship had gone on the rocks there. John Greeley takes us back to 1910 and that disaster.
By all accounts, Bly Reef and Prince William Sound were the last place any mariner wanted to be on the night of December 11th, 1910. Old-timers recall it was one of the worst nights for weather ever seen on the Sound, but there was the steamship Olympia, sailing from Cordova to Valdez. Built in Scotland 25 years before, the Olympia was 335 feet long and weighed 2,800 tons. For a time, early in the century, the Olympia plied the trade routes between Seattle and China. But now it was on the Seattle-Alaska run, and the night it ran into trouble on Bly Reef, the Olympia had 133 passengers and crew aboard. About 11:30 at night, with the high winds kicking up freezing spray, the ship's captain, James Daniels, knew he was in trouble. The Olympia would not respond to his commands, and as they approached the reef making little headway, the winds literally blew her onto the rocks. According to a 1968 account of the shipwreck in the magazine Alaska Sportsman, Captain Daniels first feared that the Olympia would sink after ripping out its bottom. But as fortune would have it 79 years ago, the Olympia, like her ill-fated super-cousin the Exxon Valdez, hit Bly Reef in such a way as to leave it firmly impaled on the rocks. When he figured he wouldn't sink right away, Captain Daniels radioed for help. Cordova got the first word, but because of the storm, it would be 2 days before the people aboard the Olympia would make it to safety. A fire broke out aboard the Olympia, but seawater entering the shattered hull put that out. Finally, on December 12th, all passengers and crew were evacuated safely from Bly Reef. It's not reported in the Alaska Sportsman account of the shipwreck whether any oil was lost from the Olympia. At the time, its owners, the Alaska Steamship Company, thought the vessel would break up and sink in a matter of days. But the Olympia turned into something of a landmark in Prince William Sound. Instead of breaking up, she just rusted and sat there for more than a decade before finally going to pieces. So, somewhere under the shattered hull of the Exxon Valdez, underneath all that oil lies the wreckage of the steamship Olympia. It's probably no consolation to the Exxon Corporation, and certainly not to the residents of Prince William Sound, to know that this is not the first disaster to make Bly Reef famous. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Legislation to change the oil industry tax break, known as ELF, moved out of one Senate Judiciary Committee as the oil industry admitted that it's pulled all its anti-ELF advertising from Alaska media in the wake of the Valdez oil disaster. House Bill 118, which has already cleared the House, passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon. None of the five senators on the committee, however, recommended that the full Senate pass the measure. Meanwhile, BP spokesman Paul Laird told the Associated Press that all oil industry public relation ads were pulled earlier this week. Laird said, if anything is still running, it's a mistake. A Fairbanks battery manufacturer was added today to the EPA's Superfund cleanup list. The Environmental Protection Agency found traces of lead in the soil around the business and last year began a cleanup of the property. As Robin Martin reports, the final bill for the cleanup should be split up among the polluters, one of whom is the U.S. Air Force.
About 25 years ago, Earl Romans developed a battery that would stand up to the sub-zero temperatures and dry weather of the interior. People liked them for cars, and the product was such high quality that Romans began to develop batteries for planes as well. He began selling them to the Strategic Air Command at Eielson Air Force Base, and he also sold to commercial truck, taxi, and airline fleets. Romans got a lot of his materials by recycling old, used batteries. People would trade in their old batteries when they came to buy one of his heavy-duty variety. He also bought them from the military and other government agencies. Now, those parties may be named as polluters, according to Jim Everett, chief of the Superfund investigation for this region.
We look for either the property owners, transporters, generators, anybody who may have been associated with the waste that has been disposed at the site, and from that list, we attempt to find individuals who will pay for the cleanup.
Everett says the trouble began when the old plastic battery cases began to stack up in Romans' yard. He had them crushed up to stabilize the swampy ground around his house. Now those cases still contain traces of lead. The EPA found as much as 16% lead in the soil around Romans' property. They drilled test wells nearby, but did not find lead in the aquifer. However, the lead in the soil is laced with acid and is highly soluble, making it a potential hazard. That's why it got onto the Superfund cleanup list. The EPA is proceeding with cleanup, which has been estimated to cost $1.6 million. Jim Everts of EPA says the agency will seek to recover the costs of cleanup from the polluter. But Romans isn't the only party involved. Anyone who gave or sold him a battery is potentially liable. That means the Air Force, National Guard, Army, and lots more government agencies that dumped their used batteries with Earl Romans.
There have been other circumstances where the government has helped pay for Superfund sites that have been contaminated with their waste.
Everett says he doubts the EPA would try to collect from individuals that recycled their batteries through Roman. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
Alaska Battery Enterprises shouldn't be confused with another Fairbanks business, Alaskan Battery Supply. 45 workers at the Wrangell Forest Products Mill are at work today, cleaning up and loading a ship after yesterday's notice that the mill will be closing indefinitely. Rhonda Lichwark and Zoe Harrigus report.
The mill's operator, Steve Seeley, says the lack of logs to run the mill and the problem of where to dump wood waste have contributed to the closure. The secretary for the Paper Workers International Union 1341, Penny Sims, says the mill closure was unexpected for many of Wrangell workers. She says the workers normally expect a closure in December when the mill closes for maintenance.
There's a lot of people that are just trying to sit tight and hang on and wait for a month or so just to see what's going to happen. I do know of a couple of guys that their wives are getting ready to have babies and stuff, and they're pretty scared. They don't know, you know, is their insurance going to be there long enough for when their wives are due or exactly what they should do.
Wrangell's Chamber of Commerce President Bill Privett said yesterday that Wrangell now has 29% to 30% unemployment. Sims says if the closure is a long one, this figure could rise even further as a cut in money in town impacts on the rest of the community. She says she doesn't know how many of the mill workers are going to be unable to pay bills or will have to leave town to get work, but she says she knows they're out there.
One reason mill operator Steve Seeley cited for the shutdown was the application for a tidelands fill for wood waste now before the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm Zoe Harrigus. The mill's proposal for a tidelands fill permit has to go through a state review before it can be approved by the Corps. the head of the state's Division of Governmental Coordination out of the governor's office, says the state has completed its interagency review of the mill's proposal, along with a serious examination of the mill's adjacent upland waste disposal site, locally known as Mount Seeley. Mayor says agencies of the federal government still have to approve the plans, though. She says the National Marine Fisheries, Fish and Wildlife, and the Environmental Protection Agency all have to agree that the negotiated agreement with the mill will solve waste problems before the Corps will grant the mill's permit. Those agencies initially objected to the permit. Mayor says conditions have been revised since then. Comments from federal agencies to the Corps are advisory, and Mayor says the decision to grant the permit now rests with the Corps. In Wrangell, I'm Zoe Harrigus.
Mill operator Steve Seeley says the lack of logs is one of the principal reasons for the closure. Seeley says the sawmill relies heavily on the Alaska Pulp Corporation's long-term timber sale and a supply of logs from the U.S. Forest Service. Cutbacks in the APC's long-term sales, current harvest areas, and environmental lawsuits have contributed to the low log supply. APC's public relations officer, Rollo Poole, says a part of the log shortage is attributable to the harsh winter. In some areas, the logging trucks had to contend with up to 12 feet of snow on the roads. And he says, although he can't give figures on how much of APC's logging areas tied up in environmental and subsistence lawsuits at the moment, he believes it affects at least three or four areas.
Now, the market, I don't know if it's ever been better for pulp and even for sawn timber, but the problem that we have to look at is not so much selling it, because we could sell more if we could produce more. The problem is worrying about a log supply, not only for this year, but for years to come. And that's one thing, with more areas being taken out of timber harvest availability, it puts a crunch on the existing timber harvest areas, and it makes it harder to get the wood out.
That was the APC's public relations officer in Sitka, Rollo Poole. In Wrangell, I'm Rhonda Litchwark.
And finally, the Anchorage Daily News has done it again. They won the big one, the Pulitzer Prize. They got the Pulitzer Prize Public Service Award for their series People in Peril, profiling the effects of alcohol in Alaska Native villages. Howard Weaver, managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News, was the reporter who brought the Pulitzer home the first time for a series on the Teamsters Union influence on the state. This time he guided a crew of reporters in coverage that caused many communities to think again about the human cost of alcohol on Alaska's native people. Today, the news that the paper had won the Pulitzer Prize brought joy, not pain.
It's the kind of thing that you don't think will ever happen to you once in your life, and to have it happen twice is a feeling that's beyond description.
Anchorage Daily News Managing Editor Howard Weaver. And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Thursday, the 30th of March. We had reports tonight from Bob King of KDLG reporting from Valdez, Earl Finkler and David Harding of KBRW in Barrow, John Greeley of KTOO in Juneau, and Rhonda Litchwark and Zoe Harrigus of KSTK in Wrangell. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Valdez, Peter Kenyon from Juneau, Robin Martin from Fairbanks, Sue Burris, and Johanna Urich from Anchorage. Diana Derby is our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state, by the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512, and by Mark Air and Mark Air Express. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good evening, stations. This is the Alaska Public Radio Network Actuality Service for this Thursday, the 30th of March, and we have one piece of brand new material for you. It is a segment of an interview with Senator Frank Murkowski, talking about giving us reassurance, essentially, that the oil spill is not quite as bad as many thought it was. The piece runs...
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by ARCO Alaska, working to build a strong future for Alaska, by National Bank of Alaska, proud sponsor of the Iditarod and all that's Alaskan.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The Exxon Valdez oil spill continues to spread, shifting its direction to threaten more fishing grounds and wildlife habitat in Prince William Sound and out into the Gulf of Alaska. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, security in Valdez is clamped down. Plans to refloat the stricken tanker raise new fears. Oil prices rise as the state gets some encouraging new revenue forecasts. The Exxon Valdez oil spill now covers an area the size of Rhode Island. The Department of Environmental Conservation estimated the size of the spill today at more than 1,000 square miles. Bob King reports on the latest changes in the oil slick itself.
The most dramatic development of the day is the spread of oil south and east to Hinchinbrook Island. So far, most of the oil has been wind-driven to the southwest. But the Department of Environmental Conservation's latest map shows heavy oil now in Hinchinbrook entrance to the south, and a sheen extending east towards Orcas Inlet. That inlet, where the city of Cordova is located, is also a major otter habitat, with more than half the Sound's population of otters there. As of this afternoon, Exxon officials could not confirm DEC's finding of oil near Hinchinbrook. Spokesman Brian Dunphy said their cleanup effort had not mobilized there.
As far as I'm aware, no, there is not. We're concentrating on the key environmentally sensitive areas that have been identified on Knight Island, Ingen Island, Naked Island, some of those on that the other side of the channel where the majority of the oil has concentrated.
Okay. In that area to the west, much of the effort has been organized around what Exxon calls the Battle of Sawmill Bay. Three booms have been placed across the bay to protect the San Juan hatchery. A fourth sea curtain is also being put in place, and 10 skimmers are standing by. But it still is a defensive battle against an ever-spreading onslaught of oil. Meanwhile, there's no estimation of the number of seabirds or marine mammals killed by the spills so far. Only three birds have actually been brought in for cleanup. Biologists stress, though, that the immediate body count is of less concern than the long-term damage to the habitat. Fish and Game's Kathy Frost.
It's easy to go out and focus on body counts because you see those animals in front of you, and that's a devastating sight. It impacts all of us. But longer term, many of those beaches are going to remain oiled a month from now or 2 months from now, and depending on how that oil does or doesn't change, it poses a future, you know, problem to other animals coming in, clean birds coming into the area or clean mammals coming into the area a month from now or 6 weeks from now, again encounter that oil even though the immediacy of the spill's gone by.
In Valdez, I'm Bob King.
As the impact of the catastrophe in Prince William Sound begins to sink in, it's putting a heavy emotional and physical strain on everyone trying to deal with it. Today, the lid came down. Security forces appeared all over the town of Valdez. The Coast Guard clamped a 1,000-foot flight restriction on planes flying over the spill, and Exxon abruptly cut off a news conference. Steve Heimel has more.
The news conference dissolved in chaos when people began shouting from the back of the room. Up till this event, the public had been admitted and allowed to ask questions, just like the news media. But now the media was cordoned off, and security guards were posted at the entrances, examining all parcels. Security guards have also gone up at the airport, the state offices, and at the Bird and Mammal Treatment Center. It's not clear why all the restrictions have come down. Officials say it's to enable people to get on with their work. The Coast Guard says its flight restrictions are due to too much traffic, but the result makes it a lot harder to get information. Don Cornett of Exxon was tight-lipped as he left the news conference by the back door.
Where is the tanker going to go now?
I don't know.
You know, it hasn't been decided.
Who's paying the security people here?
We're paying the security people.
How many are there?
I don't know.
Confusion has almost become a byword of the events surrounding the Exxon Valdez catastrophe. Some of the logistical problems strain credibility. Doris Nofsky lives in a former tourist lodge in one of the coves of the affected area of Knight Island. She's been listening to the confusion on the radio over the past few days as she tries to stay on top of the movement of the oil and the progress of the booming off efforts.
It is the biggest comedy show I've heard in a long time. All we have everything is so busy out there. All we've really been able to get on our radio is the marine operator, John Stone Point. We listen to them constantly. So it's a one-sided conversation. Every boat that calls in to the communication center, wherever they're calling, talks to a different person. Every person tells a different story or where to go or what to do. We had three boats at Thumb Bay looking for a big boat. I can't remember the name of it, but the mother boat that they were supposed to court off Thumb Bay. Then they were sent to East Chamois. They were told they weren't wanted at East Chamois to go to Main Bay. They didn't want them at Main Bay, then they went down to Sawmill. These are all the hatcheries. Then they were sent back up to East Chamois. And all these boats were full, or two of them were full of booming. But nobody knew where they wanted to be, where they wanted them to go.
There's a lot of confusion you're hearing?
Yes, very confusing.
Nofsky herself has been trying to offer the use of the lodge for scientists trying to rescue or assess the damage to wildlife, but so far regulatory roadblocks have rendered this impossible.
Everything has to be to code. The lodge has not been opened up for years, so things aren't to code. But we have to have all the treatment centers. We have to have the water treatment centers, sewer treatment centers, all this for an emergency situation. There's an outhouse. Have people been using outhouses for centuries? What difference is it going to make? I've been living out there since September, drinking the water out of the stream, and I am not sick in the least. But if I have people come out there, they say that they're going to get sick from this. And I'm not, so I don't see why anybody else should.
Accounts like this are commonplace. Supplies not being picked up, crews sitting idle all day, and so forth. In all, it appears that more than an entire week will go by with no sign of an end to the confusion that seemingly plagues all efforts to deal with this spill. For APRN and Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
So far, Valdez Harbor and the waters close to town have been spared the worst effects of the Exxon Valdez disaster. But in order to repair the ruptured hull of the 987-foot tanker, Valdez residents may have to face one of their worst fears, seeing the leaking supertanker come limping back into the harbor with up to 50,000 barrels of oil mixed with seawater still in its fractured tanks. Peter Kenyon reports.
Exxon USA President William Stevens says the most important operation going on in Prince William Sound right now is the unloading and refloating of the Exxon Valdez. The company now says it will be at least Sunday before they'll be ready to try and refloat the vessel. Workers now have about half of the million barrels that remained in the Exxon Valdez transferred to other tankers. That means there's still twice as much oil on the wounded tanker as there is in the water, and that's what makes this transfer operation so critical. One false move and the largest spill in North America could triple in size. Stevens says they feel more comfortable about getting the oil off safely with each passing day, but another storm is brewing after that job is finished. Salvage experts have concluded that they will not be able to get all the oil off the tanker, and the oil that can't be removed is in the punctured tanks, Exxon's William Stevens.
Keep in mind, we've got a number of breached cargo compartments that are open to the ocean that have a mixture of oil and water in them. And the technical assessment is that somewhere between 3% and 5% of the million barrels that stayed on the vessel will exist in this very dilute oily water phase.
That's 30 to 50,000 barrels of oil that will still be in the open tanks when the vessel is refloated and towed for temporary repairs. And where will it be towed? The options are extremely limited. In order to patch the hull, Exxon will need heavy lifting equipment capable of handling huge steel plates and other specialized gear. The tanker can't be moved into the open ocean before it's patched. Stevens says the Coast Guard hasn't made a final decision yet, but he quoted Admiral Nelson as saying the best option appears to be to take it right back into the port of Valdez. And if there's one thing in the world the people of Valdez don't want to see right now, it's the Exxon vessel.
Yesterday,
I made a fairly strong statement that under no circumstances did I want that tanker back in this port.
Mayor John Devon says since then he's discovered that the Coast Guard has more muscle than he does on this issue, and he now says if they decide that's where the tanker has to go, that's where it goes. But he's going to fight it any way he can. Devon says local residents have been struggling to keep the oil out of sensitive areas of Prince William Sound around the clock for days now, and that's exactly what could happen if they try to maneuver a leaking tanker into the city dock.
They bring that that tanker in here leaking oil, and we're going to have oil in Valdez Bay. It's going to impact on our hatchery. We've got wetlands up here that we've been protecting. We have lots and lots of ducks and geese and other waterfowl that come in here. The city dock that they would want to tie that thing to is adjacent to this waterfowl area.
Stevens downplays the potential for another large spill when they move the vessel. He says there probably will be a sheen as it moves, but he calls that an insignificant amount of oil. When pressed for details, however, he admits that the experts have no way to be sure of that.
There's no way to make a judgment there. No way at all.
Devon says the people of Valdez will do everything humanly possible to help with this cleanup, and he won't put unnecessary roadblocks in the way. Right now, he's hoping the Coast Guard can find some other place to patch up the Exxon Valdez. But if the choice is the Valdez City Dock, Devon says they're going to hear from him.
You can bet I'll be yelling real loud and real hard. We want to cooperate with them. We want to do everything we can to help them get over this emergency, but it doesn't mean adding insult to injury.
Coast Guard spokesperson Ed Morath said Friday afternoon that no decision had been made yet on where to take the Exxon Valdez. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Getting oil spill cleanup supplies to the islands of Prince William Sound is a time-consuming and often dangerous operation. The state's using the Alaska National Guard to coordinate the supply routes to hatcheries and other affected areas. Claire Richardson went on one mission to the salmon hatchery on Evans Island, where fishermen have successfully boomed the entrance to San Juan Bay.
The Sikorsky Sky Crane looks like a giant praying mantis. The cargo helicopter can hold up to 25,000 pounds of equipment, but on this run, only a few hundred feet of boom, an outboard motor, and some rakes are being taken to help secure the San Juan hatchery. That's where millions of pink salmon fry are being raised. This is one of 18 flights requested by the state in a day. Pilot Dave Benish says the sky crane can be used for all sorts of operations.
One of the things that allows us to do is we can land on any sandbar or flat beach that's on any particular island. So when you get to the cleanup crews, we can actually put them in the aircraft and fly them out there, and they can go out and clean up the island. Along with that, of course, we can take, say, 10 people and all their gear.
The sky crane passes over Naked Island, where tendrils of oil spill curve into coves, sitting thick on top of the land and water.
Black sand beach, Hawaii. Yeah, it's all black. Look at where the tides come in, you know, up above the oil. Nice gray, and then you got the oil there to make it all black.
The cargo helicopter nears the hatchery, 8 miles from the spill. Small fishing boats dot the water, and a yellow line can be seen drawn across the bay. It is a boom, plastic tubes that are meant to hold the oil back from the hatchery. The huge chopper lands on a sandy beach to offload supplies. A fisherman, Craig Matkin of Homer, is in a skiff nearby. Matkin has been on the job 48 hours. He looks cold and weary. The booms are in place, but whether they can protect the hatchery, he says no one knows.
When the wind blows like it is now, or if it gets worse, there's some doubt as to whether they'll stop the oil anyway, but at least we're getting booms in place. And we have the absorbent pads now, too, that have all been dropped, and they'll be behind the boom, so...
The hatchery is owned by the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, which means fishermen like Matkin are part owners.
Fishermen have a stake in it. We pay so much in dues every year. And we also, a certain percentage of what we get paid on fish goes to the hatchery. So we all have a stake in this, a big stake. We put a whole lot of money into this hatchery, and that's why we're all out here.
The fishermen walk to and from the sky crane, carrying the rakes, motor oil, and a few bags of absorbent pads. The Sikorsky was only a third full on this run, but some supplies are better than none. Dan Garner with the Department of Environmental Conservation doesn't want to offload the boom on the beach, so a decision is made for the sky crane to drop the yellow snake-like tubing out onto the water near the boats. The pilot makes a wind check.
But I was doing a 100-mile-an-hour check here to see how bad the wind is, okay?
There ain't no wind.
We're not 100 yet either. Okay, there you go. 100 miles an hour. How's your ride?
There ain't no wind.
Okay, we don't have to worry about it then.
Ready for the first bomb run.
Okay, stand by there, Scott.
Okay.
Hey, don't get any lower, Bob. Just slow now. Slow. Stop.
Not
okay,
wind.
Do it. Higher, Bob, higher. Okay, right there. That's good. Right there. How are we doing?
After two passes, the job is completed, but even the pilot can't believe how little boom he was actually carrying.
That boom that we dropped isn't even worth carrying. Look at how short this stuff is. I didn't know 1,000 feet.
And I don't know.
Down below, fishermen lean over boats to grab the material and attach it to a boom that is ripped. The sky crane heads back to Valdez to land, refuel, and head out once again on another mission. Aboard the Alaska National Guard sky crane, I'm Claire Richardson.
I couldn't hear you, sir, but 483, I'd like to advise you from present position to the area in front of our vehicle, sir. Here it is requested on the ice. Thank you.
1 foot.
You're listening to Alaska News Nightly from the Alaska Public Radio Network. Still to come, rising oil prices make for an optimistic state revenue forecast. Up next, Congress begins investigations into the disaster and its implications for other development. In the aftermath of the worst oil spill in U.S. history, Congress is cranking up the machinery of its hearing process in an effort to figure out what happened and what implications the Exxon Valdez spill might have for the future of development in Anwar. Joel Southern reports from Washington.
The House Merchant Marine Coast Guard Subcommittee convenes next Thursday. The Senate Environmental Protection Subcommittee could hold hearings within the next 2 weeks. The chairman of the House Interior Water Resources Subcommittee, a strong opponent of Anwar development, will likely visit the oil spill site soon to see the damage firsthand. From one side of Congress to the other, those opposed to Anwar development and those questioning the reliability of the oil industry's promises to protect the environment are gearing up for a fight. Defenders of development are ready. Congressman Billy Tozan, chairman of the Coast Guard Subcommittee, spoke by phone from his district in Louisiana, where oil is still king.
This was an oil tanker accident. And we've been saying for a long time that development of coastal resources for this nation that don't rely upon transshipments of oil, whether they come from the Alaska North Slope, whether they come from foreign sources, is in this nation's interest. It wasn't the pipeline that ruptured and caused the problem. It wasn't oil spill at an oil well facility. It was the shipment of oil on the high seas.
Statistically, Tozan says oil spills occur most frequently during transshipment of oil to the nation's ports.
And what we've been saying for a long time is that environmentally sound development of our nation's own resources for the good of our own country makes much better sense than relying upon shipments of oil from wherever they're coming in. And that if we can, in fact, produce oil and gas in America, for America, we're always better off.
Still, Tozan concedes the Exxon Valdez was a big political setback for defenders of the oil industry and North Slope development.
I think the oil spill from this tanker was an open invitation to those who oppose any kind of offshore development, our development in Alaska, to come in and make a case now that that in fact this damage is not worth the risk you take when you develop oil. But we're not living in a risk-free environment.
Tozan says the challenge is to minimize those risks and to be better prepared to deal with an accident when one happens, not to give up on domestic oil. But Tozan and the Alaska delegation are braced for a possible onslaught of opposition once Congress gets back next week. The Exxon Valdez was far from ANWR when it unleashed more than 10 million gallons of thick crude last week in Prince William Sound. But the political oil slick from that mishap now stretches all the way to Washington and back up to Alaska's North Slope. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
The Exxon Valdez oil spill continues to stir political ripples within the state as well. In Kodiak, there's new concern about what could happen if drilling goes forward in Bristol Bay or if the Shelikof Strait is open to oil development. In the past, Kodiak's Outer Continental Shelf Advisory Council hasn't opposed development, but the Exxon disaster has shaken their faith. Charlene Parent has the story.
The OCS Advisory Council is asking the Borough Assembly to pass a resolution opposing drilling in Bristol Bay. If drilling does go forward, a pipeline would be constructed across the Alaska Peninsula with a terminal built on the Shelikof Strait. Chairman Hank Pennington says the OCS Council is worried about the potential tanker traffic in the Shelikof.
Statistically and historically, your more significant spills are always associated with the transport of oil, either pipeline or tankers running aground or tankers colliding or something like that, or the transfer of oil between terminals and tankers. That's where you spill the oil. And we've got some oil transport now in the Shelikof, or at least liquefied natural gas transport. But with a major field found in Bristol Bay or something like that, we could be talking about a lot of tankers out there, a lot of tanker activity. We could be looking at as many tankers as are coming out of Prince William Sound right now.
Besides the potential for a terminal on the Shelikof, there could be drilling there as well. A proposed lease sale is set for next year. Pennington says up till now, the borough's lack of resistance to drilling in Bristol Bay and the Shelikof has been based on oil industry assurances about what they would do in the case of a spill.
Yes, we'll use the best technology and we'll do everything we can to prevent a spill. And if one happens, you can be sure we'll move heaven and earth to get the thing cleaned up as quickly as possible. And here we have the biggest spill in the history of the nation, and it looks as though the company involved sat on their hands for several days. That bothers us.
Pennington says if the Prince William Sound disaster is representative of what can happen, the borough needs to rethink its position.
We're still not saying we oppose oil development, but we're saying, hey, let's take a real close look at it. And I think it's time, in light of the spill, for the borough to look closely at their policies.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The Exxon Valdez oil spill is sending oil prices soaring. After the tanker ran aground a week ago today, the price of West Texas Intermediate crude has hovered around $20 a barrel, and today the price reached $21.48. Simon Trimble is an international oil analyst for Shearson Lehman Hutton.
World oil prices jumped to the point where WTI, West Texas Intermediate, which is the American marker crude, was at a high not seen really since August of 1987. It was a very high price.
The reason Exxon, ARCO, and British Petroleum announced they're cutting back production on the North Slope but must break some of their contracts for oil delivery. The flow through the Trans-Alaska pipeline doesn't need to be cut back much to affect world oil prices.
People are always surprised by how little is really needed to cause major concerns in the United States. People forget that the U.S. is now a major importer of not only crude but products as well, and therefore any reduction in the flow of oil from Alaska, which is really the prime source now for the United States, is going to have a very significant impact.
In response to the disruption in supply, an oil trade letter reports that California refiners are scrambling to cover their crude oil requirements. Trimble says the actual environmental damage and potential liability suits against Exxon haven't and probably won't have much effect on the Exxon share price.
The problem is that Exxon is a very, very large company, and as such, the impact of the damage suits that could take place in Alaska, most probably in the market's eyes at the moment, would not be of a size significant enough to cause a major impact on Exxon's earnings.
Simon Trimble, international oil analyst. State lawmakers heard today that production cutbacks due to the oil spill could cost the state $25 million in revenue. But at the same time, higher world oil prices have helped shave $300 million of the state budget deficit. John Greeley has the latest revenue forecast from Juneau.
The difference between $12 oil in October and $20 oil in March shows up in the numbers produced by the state revenue department today. Higher prices and a bigger thirst for oil on the world market lead state experts to believe that Alaska will earn just about $2 billion in the next fiscal year. If that's so, Governor Cooper and the legislature are now $255 million short of paying the state's bills. That's down from a deficit of $600 million projected just a month ago. Revenue Commissioner Hugh Malone injects a note of caution in all this, saying his department settled on the $2 billion revenue figure for next year as a compromise between a low projection of $1.5 billion and a high figure of $2.5 billion.
And so the uncertainty in oil prices is clearly still with us. Right now they're up some and they're expected to stay up some. But the uncertainty is still with us, and the strategy to deal with that uncertainty is still required.
And that strategy is far from settled upon here should state officials cut the budget, raise taxes, or rob reserve accounts. No consensus in either house yet, but next week the governor and legislators are scheduled to resume their high-profile budget meetings. Cooper's staff has been working on some budget cuts, so has the House Finance Committee, but as Chairman Ron Larson said today, while they've agreed on reducing the budget, they haven't made any cuts. Larson also notified his committee that before they get to the budget reductions, there's one budget increase they'll be looking at on Monday, $20 million for the Valdez oil spill cleanup. That state expenditure will eventually get put on the doorstep of Exxon. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Friday, the 31st of March. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU and Bob King of KDLG, both reporting from Valdez. Charlene Parent of KMXT in Kodiak and John Greeley of KTOO in Juneau. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Valdez, Peter Kenyon from Juneau, and Sue Burris from Anchorage. Diana Derby is our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. Chris Badalek is engineering at KCHU in Valdez, along with Jeff Brown of KTOO in Juneau. Special thanks are due to Dave Hammock, the staff and volunteers of KCHU in Valdez. They've been working around the clock to make this coverage possible. There'll be more on your APRN station through the weekend. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by the Sheraton Anchorage, where your comfort and well-being come first, and the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, promoting quality Alaskan seafood in the domestic and international marketplace. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The following program was made possible by grants from the Alaska Fisherman's Journal, the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation, the Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, Delta Western, and the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Lainey Welch. Kodiak groups are mobilizing to get more pollock and priority access for coastal communities. Observers will be aboard many longline vessels during the entire black cod season. And Japanese market analyst Bill Atkinson talks about Prince William Sound's herring sackerel fishery. First, some fishing highlights.